Welcome to Power Players by Origis, critical thinking to deliver the promise of clean energy. This program brings you leading voices in solar and energy storage and sectors impacting renewables, exploring challenges and solutions for industry growth, the true cost of operating and maintaining power plants, and system asset management considerations. My name is Josh Corbett. I welcome you to this episode, hosted by Michael Iman, Managing Director of Origis Services. All right, welcome to the next episode of Power Players. Today we've got Kristen Lyons with Scott Madden. Kristen, as I understand it, you've been with Scott Madden since 1999 and working with their energy practice. You've got 25 years, oh my goodness, of experience helping clients to optimize their businesses as part of working at Scott Madden. And you lead client engagements to transform utility operations and enable the clean energy transition. That's a lot of words. We're going to find out what that means today. So talk to me a little bit about what you've been doing since 2018 and about Scott Madden's practice as a whole.
So great to be here, Michael. Thank you. I've been leading the energy practice since 2018, and my personal background most of the last 25 years has been on the transmission and distribution side. So before taking this role, I actually led our firm's grid transformation practice, which is really central to how the energy transition is taking place. You know, the grid is completely critical to how we're going to migrate all of these new resources onto the system. So I've been intimately involved with those issues, frankly, since before they were cool. When I started in this, everybody just worried about whether or not the lights stayed on. And today we worry about what customers are interested in terms of their preferences. We worry about how clean the energy we are using is, what sources we're using, and how people are treated in the process. So it's a completely different ballgame today. And I'm very happy to be leading our practice in this era.
So how do companies engage with Scott Madden? Like, what, when we talk about transformation of the grid, and you're working with clients and companies that are working on that, just for those of us who are not 25-year experts, what do you mean by that? What does that mean, really? Like, just baseline.
So the best way to describe it is that we help electric and gas utilities operationalize strategic imperatives. So a strategic imperative is connect more distributed resources to your distribution system. We go in and help the company figure out how they're going to change their processes to accommodate more DERs. So we help them file with the regulator to talk about how they're doing that. And we may help them file a rate case to recover the costs of doing that. So we can help when the regulator says you have to do this, or when a legislator or even a utility executive says you must do, we come in and say we can help you figure that out. And we do that across elements of the grid, transmission, distribution. We do it in generation, renewables, and in regulatory.
Okay, so what I heard from that was when a company interfaces with the grid, the government says, here's your new requirements, or these are the things that are changing. And they're like, I don't really know, like, what am I supposed to do with this? You're the 911 call to help them figure that out and to lead them through that. So, but you did say three things there that I keyed on. You talked about reliability, affordability, and clean or renewable. Talk to me about, are those sort of the three things that you're looking at today? Like, talk to me a little bit about that.
So as I mentioned before, I started in this industry before it was cool. And in an era where we really only worried about are customer bills affordable and is power reliable. And that's a pretty straightforward construct. You know, okay, we plan the system according to least cost principles and obligation to serve, and regulators set rates. You had interveners that complained about the rates. And it was a pretty straightforward kind of interaction to helping the lights stay on. And that produced low cost, reliable power for a long time. What's changed in the last decade or more is that now we worry a lot about whether the power we're using to keep the lights on is clean. So now, instead of having two imperatives, we have three. And what has emerged is a natural tension across those three. You can have a reliable solution that is low cost, but it may not be as clean as you want. You could have a clean and reliable solution that you can't afford to pay for. Or you could have the least cost solution that may not meet the goal. So that tension is really emerging. And the first place that we saw it emerge in the last year or so was on the reliability side, because we're seeing a lot of our traditional, what we call baseload generation, big coal and nuclear plants.
Right.
They're retiring and they're being replaced with resources with different operating characteristics. So think the wind doesn't blow all the time and the sun doesn't shine all the time. And as we're managing this transition, a lot of very senior people in the industry are expressing their concerns about keeping the lights on. So that's the first element of that tension. And we can talk about affordability and clean separately.
Sure. So, I mean, reliability, I mean, aren't renewables reliable? And how does reliability, we started talking about sort of the grid and transmission, right? Now you're talking about sources of power. So where does the reliability, affordability, and clean, how does that affect, where does that affect the grid, right? I mean, it's understand the sources of power and what's happening with those changing, but what are the grid requirements around that? What are the infrastructure requirements around that change?
Well, from a very basic view, it's not to suggest that intermittent resources can't be reliable, particularly when paired with other sources of power. For instance, solar and batteries make a great combination. The challenge is that the grid wasn't designed for a system that is largely based on renewables. So transmission, think high voltage, big power lines that can span multiple counties, states, even regions. They are critical to enabling those intermittent resources to connect into the grid and supply load, because those resources, think big wind, isn't typically located right next to big cities, barring Chicago, perhaps. So what you end up with,
Corpus Christi.
There you go. So what you end up with is the need to build out a lot of big lines. And, you know, I mentioned before, I was in the industry before it was cool. Well, in the early 2000s, we started working on building out a lot of transmission. Then it was because we were enabling wholesale markets and enabling everyone to get least cost power in the markets. You know, and that had its day. There was a lot of money spent in transmission. We have invested progressively less in transmission over time. And everyone's now realizing, holy cow, if we're going to connect these kinds of resources to the loads that need them, we need big wires and we need them soon. They are very, very difficult to build. Planning, siting, cost allocation are all very difficult challenges on the transmission side, but they are critical to enabling the renewables that we need in the mix.
So it occurs to me, as you were talking through that and I was thinking about this challenge, it's interesting, like the traditional forms of power, oil-fired plants, coal plants, gas, combined cycle, typically located where they need to be located and the fuel comes to them in order to provide it, right? Now you have the fuel is being provided by a resource, whether it's wind, hydro, offshore, solar, that has a geographic fixed point and the transmission has to come to it.
Yep.
Right. So it is a different dynamic from that perspective. And that would tend to drive up the cost and the requirements around transmission as you have to sort of get into the hinterland to get to where that fuel source, whether that's wind or a river that's dammed up, like Lake Mead or something like that, to get to that resource versus just putting it where you want and then bringing the fuel to it. So on the one hand, it's more efficient from a fuel transport perspective, but from a transmission of the final product, electrons, it definitely is a bigger problem set. How are we looking at that? I mean, don't we need to be looking at that nationally to really take best advantage? And does having our fragmented ISOs and like ERCOT's got its little domain here and everybody's got their little areas, is that going to have to go away or at least be mitigated somewhat with more connections between?
So
how's that going to change things?
So before I answer that question, I want to go back to the resource side for just a moment.
Sure.
So totally agree with you about the nature of those resources being very different and the fact that we need a different kind of transmission to build out that portfolio. Mm-hmm. Importantly, those resources are subject to common mode failures that a coal nuclear gas plant wouldn't be. So wind doesn't blow at night. Everybody's offline.
Yeah. Meaning the fuel.
So you can take out your whole wind portfolio.
Yeah.
Based on the weather. So that's a new dynamic that we're having to plan for. So when you think about planning transmission, you want to be able to plan to have those resources available to the best degree they can be, but to have them firmed up by, in this day and age, it's almost always gas. So right. As we're going through this transition, you've got natural gas plants playing a bigger and a different role. So the reliability of natural gas is now very much front and center. And if you looked at some of the reports after Winter Storm Elliott last year, we had, I think, 13% of the natural gas-fired capacity in the Eastern Interconnect come offline because of freezing issues or gas availability. So now you have, again, other types of resources that are becoming critical to keeping the lights on as this portfolio evolves. So going back to your question about transmission and connecting it all. I'll start off by saying, yes, it would be great if we had a national plan and we were able to build out based on that plan. We've got the best solar resources in the Southwest. We've got the best wind resources in the upper Midwest. And then you connect all the pieces and away we go. That's not the way transmission works. So transmission is FERC regulated in terms of setting its rates. But when you get down to the planning, it could be, as you mentioned, an RTO or an ISO that creates a regional plan. And then within that regional plan, you have state regulators that can approve or disapprove both the siting and permitting and the cost assignment to their customers. So you have many, many layers of approvals. And you can get all the way down into municipal approvals, depending upon what state you're in. So the idea of having a master grid plan that enables all these things has been talked about and wished for years. Sadly, that's not where we are.
You mean we can't all get together and agree on a national need? You're kidding me. I am shocked.
It's shocking. I know.
Shocking. I know. Oh my goodness. Well, so how do companies navigate this, right? Because it occurs to me, like the off-takers, and I think we need to talk about them too, but let's talk about them in a minute. You know, they're connecting to the grid, the power's connecting to the grid. Who owns the grid? Who's paying for all that? Where does that come from? It's not just like some, you know, imaginary Oz behind the curtain or something. I mean, it's got to be built. This is critical infrastructure. Who's doing what and what are the roles there?
So utilities, whether they are investor-owned utilities or public power, own the grid, to answer your question. If you live in a city like Austin, then the municipality owns the grid. And so the grid itself, and you're pointing to something that's really important in this conversation, is that the grid is owned by a lot of different players. And those may or may not own all the pieces of the grid. So for instance, if you're in New York, the utilities own wires, but they don't own generation. If you're in North Carolina, where I am, the utility owns generation, transmission, and distribution. In New York, they're part of a market. In North Carolina, we're not. So when you ask about the roles, I hate to use a consultant answer, but it depends. Because the ownership is different, and frankly, the rules can be different. At the end of the day, so two things to take away. FERC regulates transmission and the rates that can be charged there and sets the rules for markets and the way those transmission development processes evolve. States set the retail rates that companies can charge customers.
So something occurs to me here. I mean, I'm sort of getting a mental image of little grid fiefdoms, you know, where everybody sort of controls their little area. And then there's, you know, every now and again, they'll get together and go, I'll give you some if you give me some, let's put a line in. And they do that. And then they create an economic, you know, a contract or some sort of economic contractual reality to enable that. But that, you know, is certainly not very efficient. Nobody's looking at it holistically. It's a bit haphazard. And certainly makes sense as to how we got here today. But where does that go from here? I mean, is this a federal government requirement that the federal government needs to step in? You said FERC earlier. I mean, these are electrons that are traveling and being sold and paid for. Would that not fall under interstate commerce and then fall under the federal government from a constitutional perspective? Like, why have we not been able to wrap our heads around this at a federal level?
So you're right about FERC having jurisdiction over interstate commerce. Absolutely. And there's absolutely a case to be made for more interregional transfer capability. So the ability to send electrons from the Midwest, the Midcontinent Independent System Operator, the center of the country, to the Southeast or to the Northeast, absolutely a case to be made for that. But when it comes to any given state, that state regulator can make the call on whether or not those costs get allocated to their customers and whether the benefits of that line are sufficient to them. And then they can make a decision on siting accordingly. So at the end of the day, all interests are local. And that's absolutely true in this transmission challenge that we have today. The FERC is working on a notice of proposed rulemaking that I believe they're going to issue an order on in 2024 that attempts, my personal belief is that it's going to attempt to get at how do you build out a backbone grid that can support the portfolio of resources we need. I think that's where we're headed. That's my hope. But FERC can only do so much when the states continue to hold the keys to retail rates and siting.
Yeah, I mean, I think the corollary is the interstate system, right? You need sort of a national grid, which then all the local ones can sort of take an off-ramp or an on-ramp as they need to for their financial activities, whatever those are, or for the needs of their constituents and their ratepayers. Which sort of brings
we talk a lot about the national highway system as a model for the grid. And I would like it noted that 20 plus years ago when I started working in this field, that's what we were talking about, is how this is akin to the national highway system. And the need is as great, I believe, in terms of economic development and enabling the clean energy transition. But the parochial interests are much more difficult. And I think they've gotten more difficult over these past couple of decades. Yeah. It is a very, very difficult conundrum that we're in.
So I hear you. So it's 20 years, hasn't been solved. We're looking for a new rules coming out from FERC, you said, this next year, 2024. So we'll look forward to maybe when those come out, we can do another one of these and talk through the changes. I think Absolutely. That would be a great additional follow-on episode, given the fact that there'll hopefully be some substantive changes. But in the meantime, while we have these sort of fiefdoms interconnected sporadically by, you know, sort of little commercial treaties where somebody puts a line in, and I mean, that's kind of my mental model here, that means that your local, you know, utilities, your off-takers, and your customers, you know, really need to be considered in this. So talk to me a little bit about that relationship and sort of customers, off-takers, you know, utilities, big loads coming in like data centers and things like that. How do they navigate this? What is their piece of this? And maybe just take, that was a big question, maybe just take one at a time. What about utilities? What's their piece?
Well, utilities are central to the entire thing. They have the rules by which people interconnect to the grid. They hold the bag on reliability. So when the regulator of, say, North Carolina wants to know what's happening from a reliability perspective, they ask the utility. There is a critical role for keeping the lights on. And depending upon the market, the region, the state you're in, the rules for getting those resources and grid plans approved differ. They differ all over the place. But the utility is central to getting all of that built in a way that keeps the lights on over time. I think I mentioned before this inherent tension across reliable, affordable, and clean. So if you look at where we're headed today, we made assumptions about load growth coming with electrification. So load growth, just to provide a little bit of context, has been de minimis, maybe 0.5% per year for decades. So we have not seen utilities having to manage a lot of load coming on. So we've been managing the challenges that I mentioned before, reliability, affordability, and clean, in a world where we expected load growth to increase a bit because of electrification, as we move to electric vehicles and electrify heating, industrial processes, et cetera. So there were assumptions about load growing, but what we're seeing now as of 2022 are huge loads coming online. So you mentioned before, we have load growth going from projected to 2028 at 2.9%. It's now moved in 1 year to 4.7% for the country, which means that parts of the country are growing much faster.
That sounds familiar. That there was a study done recently that was published, correct? That
yes, Grid Strategies did it. It was very well done.
Yeah. So that's, you know, I think 4.7%, I think, was what you, I think, may have just said and what I recall. And you were saying it was over a five-year period, it was 0.5% before. So that's really double in the same period. Are utilities even remotely ready to address that? I mean, one data center starts at 500 megawatts.
I think what you're going to see, a couple of things, Kristen Lyon's best guess, we'll call it. We're going to start to see utilities have to ramp up quickly their ability to get this infrastructure in the ground. And in places where they have capacity on the transmission system, that's going to be pretty straightforward. It's in places where we're constrained already because of the issues that I talked about before, where we have to build new infrastructure to accommodate these loads, that we're really going to struggle. Because as I mentioned, the permitting, cost allocation, all of that, it's not like we typically build out the grid in anticipation of what's coming, because we've been able to see what's coming at a pretty fair distance. And you can say, you know, we're not going to hit a constraint on that line for another 10 years. We have time to address it. And now the constraint is showing up next year. Holy cow, what do we do with that? So utilities are starting to think about things like going in front of their regulators and saying, we have to pre-build. I've heard a number of clients talk about that idea of going before their regulator and identifying the need and say, you know, fleet electrification, for instance, is going to be a huge challenge in this part of our network. We want to build out to meet it. Will you approve that? And I think we're going to see more and more of those, but the utility is going to have to really work with the regulator to find a model that works. I think the other thing that could happen is that as states see the opportunity for economic development, we may see states step in and say, you know what, we'll help, whether it's with siting, permitting, additional tax incentives to the company that's trying to locate a facility. I think we're going to start to see some give from an economic development perspective, because we run the risk of not meeting economic development opportunities, which would be a real shame given the world we're living in today.
Yeah, I would say so. It occurs to me, you know, we talked a little bit about utilities, but I think this naturally sort of transitions into talking a little bit about the large load providers, which today is increasingly data centers, you know. So, you know, to use a monopoly phrase, you know, they sold four houses, they built their data center, now they got to figure out where are they going to put this thing. You know, how do they make those decisions? I mean, they're increasingly, like, if you're Google, Facebook, OpenAI, AI is going to be a big driver of this going forward, you know, massive, massive power requirements. And so you're one of these big entities. You've got your brand new data center that you need to go put someplace. How do you make that decision? Because you're looking nationally, even internationally, right? But it's a combination of factors. And if you don't have a wire to plug that thing into to get the power, you know, you're dead in the water.
So I have to assume that access to power is going to be critical, and the price at which you can get it. So you can change the economics of a facility by increasing the cost per kilowatt hour by 10 cents. You know, that totally changes things. I also think we're going to start to see some of these big loads look at self-supplying a portion of their own power use. So they may say, okay, the utility can provide X amount of capacity in the next year. What if I'm able to provide on-site generation, combination of some sort of renewables with energy storage, a battery that can help see me through until I get everything from the utility. Or we may see circumstances in which they really move to some sort of a microgrid and self-supply almost entirely. I think that's a very expensive way to go. But if we see constraints that keep them from deploying these data centers, it could be that they would prefer to locate in the US rather than move abroad, as you mentioned. And if that's the case, we may see some very creative solutions from some of these large off-takers.
Yeah, it occurs to me, microgrid, as you said, it's going to be very expensive. And then you're going to deal with your own intermittency issues and things like that. Connecting to the grid require, as a sole source, may require maybe more load than it can really handle holistically or is ready for. It seems to me there's really a space for hybrid solutions where, these data centers come in, they connect to the grid, they've got some on-site storage, and then there's some back and forth, right? You can help to firm the grid with the batteries and the production that you have on site. You can do ancillary services, you can do voltage and frequency regulation, you can do reactive power, you can do, some give and take on the storage to help firm the grid up as a whole, and thereby getting to a lowest cost per megawatt or kilowatt hour, while at the same time providing a higher quality service in both directions. Am I just pie in the sky, or do you see that happening?
I don't think that's pie in the sky at all. And I think we have seen there are providers that operate in organized markets that leverage customers to do just that. Demand response is a service.
Yeah.
And you can bid in capacity in a market with demand response. And I think under FERC Order 2222, which is in the process of being implemented in the RTOs and ISOs, we're going to see more and more of those types of solutions. So I think the idea of passive customers, particularly commercial and industrial customers, is going to become passe over time. This idea of the virtual power plant is going to become more and more important, particularly as customers can make money playing in these markets. So if in a market or in any kind of organized construct where you have a capacity need, you need to meet a certain number of megawatts.
Yeah.
You could have a provider that can aggregate storage from this customer, some demand response from that customer, energy efficiency from someone else, maybe managed charging for electric vehicles. You aggregate all of those together and bid them into a market or just meet a reliability need. That's a virtual power plant.
What does aggregate mean?
So pulling all of those resources together to meet a need.
Well, I get that part, but what is it? Like, what are you talking about? I mean, we're throwing wires over the fence. Like, what are we doing here?
It's typically metering arrangements. So it's about metering the power and settling. That's why I think it's mostly in markets where that's going to be useful, except where you've got a reliability need. So if you have, in the same way, going back to the 70s, for instance, you used to have what we called interruptible customers and contracts. So the load got really high and you had contracts with customers where they would just take off their demand. They would shut off power for you and you would be able to drop that peak demand a bit. It's the same exact concept with just a little bit more technology around it. And people now get paid for it.
Is that the kind of stuff you guys would help people figure out?
We do, yes.
Perfect. It occurs to me, we haven't talked about the customers, which maybe is apropos given the fact that I think all of us as customers are sort of used to being last in this conversation, it seems, all this stuff happens and then somebody says, oh, by the way, here's your bill. Thank you very much, right? So let's talk about the customers a little bit. What is their piece in this?
Well, so for a long time, we've talked about how the utility customer is evolving. And I'll start off by saying when I started in this industry, again, it was a long time ago, but customers were at best ratepayers.
Yeah.
And at worst, they were load. That was it. And now we have customers that have different attributes and needs and can actively participate with the utility in a way that was that's been unprecedented up to this point. So we have programs and opportunities for customers to participate in things like demand response, or you can have control over my thermostat and I will get a reduced rate on my electric bill as a result. So the interaction between the utility and the customer is evolving, and I think it'll continue to. I think the big challenge that we're going to see in the era that I mentioned, going back to reliable, affordable, and clean, is that the cost of what we're trying to do with the grid is exorbitant. We are going to have to build out a lot of new power plants. We're going to have to build out a lot of new wires. We have programs that are going to need to be funded on a lot of different levels. You know, you think about EV infrastructure make ready. The customer pays for all that, whether they have an EV or not. So the question of can all of our customers afford what electricity is going to cost over time is front and center for regulators. And I think we're going to see two things happen there. I think it means regulators are going to take a hard look at the capital plans that utilities are putting forward, and that's happening today. And I think we're also going to see programs to really engage customers to help them pay for the bills that are increasing over time.
Yeah, I think that same study we mentioned before, I think they were north of $600 billion over the next 5 years of increased spending beyond the baseline that is not sort of expected today, but that we've got to go dig out of the couch cushions, right? Somehow.
Those bills are showing up a lot of places. The clean energy transition is not free. We may have, if you just take the cost of a kilowatt of solar, that may be lower than another type of resource, but the transmission line to connect it wasn't free. And it doesn't run at night. So you need something else to run at night. So there are a lot of elements of this that we have resources that are coming online that do cost less on a per kilowatt or a per megawatt hour basis. But the things to make all of these pieces that are becoming much more complex work together are expensive.
Well, I'll tell you, from my perspective, I think the front lines of this little battle is at my thermostat, where Austin Energy sets it to this, and I set it to that, and we set it to this, and I set it to that, and we're sort of fighting over what temperature my house should be. Things have changed, from the time that you could say this is what it is to now it's somebody else has an opinion of what my thermostat is set at, and it's not me. But that $600 billion has to come from somewhere. And in my work with utilities, the interesting comments I've always had around capital investments were, it's okay, we can rate base it. Which means, here's your bill, Mr. Customer, right? But it seems customers increasingly have a louder and louder voice, not just on the price that they pay, but on, is that green power, right? Is that meeting my needs, not just from a temperature of my house perspective, but my needs from a, what do I expect from the energy mix? Is that a true thing? Is that really true? Or is it just window dressing? We'll make you feel good about feeling like you have a voice, but we're going to go get the cheapest form of power and you're just going to pay what you pay.
I think there are many kind of green kilowatt hour programs out there. And I think they're true. The piece that I'd take you back to is customers didn't used to care beyond whether their lights were on. And, back in the good old days, we had rate cases where you had interveners, and you had to be very, very interested in utility regulation to be an intervener.
Yeah.
Today, what's happening is you have stakeholder processes that are meant to actively engage these communities around the kind of infrastructure that the utilities are building. And that's a whole new paradigm for utility planning. And I think that we're just at the front end of that. That's very much a state-by-state process, and each state's kind of doing it their own way, if they're doing it at all. But I think we're going to see more and more engagement of customers to say, okay, this is what we're planning. Does this meet what your community's interested in?
Yeah, and I've seen an increase in what I would, with my military background, called influence operations, people with political agendas shaping the discourse to an outcome, not always in a completely honest way. or even remotely honest way. You know, how do customers navigate that when you have people telling you BS, you know, because it's coming from an agenda?
I think it's on each of us to be responsible consumers of the products we choose to consume. Yeah. I think the utility industry, because it's complicated and regulated in a way most people don't understand, is more difficult to understand as an end-use consumer. But all of these proceedings are public. And if people are very interested, then they can go find out for themselves what's happening at their own utility commission. How is this program paid for? What are the components of my bill? And when they're not clear, they can call, you know, whether it's the commission or their utility to find out more. I'll grant you, there are other industries that may be easier to understand than this one, but I think it's incumbent upon all of us to be as well educated about what we're consuming as we can.
I think that's true. I also think it's an impossible ask of the general population. People are not, you know, to dig into your utility and understand, I think you said it earlier, right? You've got to really be motivated if you want to chase a rate case or something like that. And by motivated, I mean, you need a lot of time and you need a lot of money and you need lawyers and you've got to, you know, have somebody. It's not simple. And to be blunt, I don't think it was intended to be transparent structurally, right? Maybe that is changing. I don't know. Do you have a sense?
Well, I think that's the goal of the stakeholder processes that many states are undertaking, is to open up the utility planning process to have more people engaged and educated about how it works.
Yeah. Look, I'm not throwing stones here. I think utilities have a tough, this is a tough thing to navigate, you know, given where we started, right? Where we are today and where we started 20 years ago in this conversation. That said, I'm hopeful that we are moving forward. And I think the takeaway for me, the positive takeaway is that, you know, customers, big load off takers have a voice. And that was not always the case even 10 years ago. And I think the direction of that from this conversation and from what I see out there is that it's going to be becoming more so, which is going to mean there's going to be more and more players looking to shape the you know, what those voices hear and say, and the politics are going to play out. But hopefully, you know, customers having some voice in this process will ultimately lead to a better solution. I'm gonna put on my rose-colored glasses and hope that's the case.
I hope so.
But I think it's gonna be a rocky ride.
The other thing I would add to what you just described is, you know, going back to that triumvirate of clean, affordable, and reliable. The lack of understanding about the way we keep the lights on is also true in the policymaking space. And as I think about some of the ambitious targets we've put out there, it's not always clear to me personally that the stakeholders and policymakers have fully understood what it takes to get to that level of renewable integration, for instance. There is a belief that, you know, the wind blows and it's free. And as long as that remains one of the things that's out there, I think it can be very hard for whoever's building the infrastructure to say, actually, if we're going to build out a grid that can accommodate that, it's going to be billions of dollars. Yeah. And that disconnect between on the policy side, I think really requires additional education as well to make informed trade-offs across those priorities. And those three priorities are not the only ones that exist there. But informed trade-offs is pretty critical in this conversation.
Yeah, and I think the informed part is the challenge, right? Understanding what those trade-offs are, depending on where you're at, whether you're a utility, whether you're a governmental entity, whether you're a customer, whether you're a large load, you know, I think that's going to be the key. And working with folks like yourself and practices like Scott Madden and to help navigate that, I think is going to be required. So I think you guys are positioned in a great spot. You're so good, Kristen. Normally, I try to circle things back to where we started, but you went right back to the triangle at the beginning. So we've already covered that. You did my job for me. Thank you. Before we close out, though, do you have any final thoughts for customers, load off takers, utilities, like any sort of like think about this as you go forward?
So the thing I'll end on is that we talked about the balkanization of the grid before and the fact that we have many, many, many entities. Importantly, we have disaggregated the pieces of this grid in such a way that it makes it very hard to look at the trade-offs we just talked about. So we have generation-only companies. We have transmission-only companies. We have integrated utilities that have all of the above. We have wires-only companies and markets. So across the spectrum, we've got companies that have their own service territories and their own sets of assets. And we really lack the ability to integrate the pieces to think holistically about the problem we're trying to solve, which is to create a reliable, affordable, clean grid. So the challenge that I would put out there is for all the players we just talked about to think about the integration of those pieces and think constructively about where we can create trade-offs across those. You know, if a solution is going to be exorbitantly expensive for customers, where can we make compromises, whether it's in the time scale that we're looking at or in the breadth of a solution that we're looking at? And that integration of pieces, both across, you know, interconnections and the like that you talked about, across companies and service territories and across asset classes, is really important right now.
Well, it sounds to me like people really need services like Scott Madden provides. This is a very complicated thing. I think understanding where you're at it, where you're at in the process, what piece of it is yours, and then reaching out to the right experts to help you optimize that and sort of chart that forward is going to be the key for most folks. Well, I think we've reached the end of today's. Kristen, you are indeed a power player. This has been a fantastic episode. I'm going to have to watch it again so that I fully understand everything you brought to this conversation. Thank you so much for your time. And let's talk again when FERC 2024 hits.
Thank you so much. It was great talking with you.
Great talking to you too.
Find summary thoughts on this topic and more insights into operating your clean energy assets at OrigisServices.com. Thank you for listening to this episode of Power Players by Origis, critical thinking to deliver the clean energy promise.